Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm one of your hosts, Kimmy Dion. This week, we are sharing an interview done by one of our non-resident fellows from last season, Takondwa Sampere, who is now a graduate student and Knight Hennessy Scholar at Stanford University. She speaks with Kalila Logan about Black African diaspora and their relationships with the continent. With the emphasis in recent years on Black travel and the government of Ghana setting up return to Africa initiatives that target the Black diaspora and set up pathways for travel and return to other African countries, Takondwa knew this would be a meaningful conversation contributing to the larger discourses of Blackness, power, and geopolitics. In addition, the prevalence of social media and cultural productions that purport to bridge the two groups together signal that there is a renewed sort of interaction between the two groups outside of the United States. Her guest this week, Kalila Logan, is a creative strategist, art director, curriculum developer, and storyteller with a background that ranges across the global social impact sector. Her expressive footprint blends culture and data to synthesize ideas and execute projects that are visually appealing, impactful, and authentic. Her values, passion for learning, and global experience drive the intention within her work, which has taken her to Ghana, Tanzania, and a few other African countries. What does Takondwa's conversation with Lila spark for you? We always welcome listener feedback. Just email us at ufahamuafrica@gmail.com. Now let's have a listen to their chat.
In 2015, I read an article by Nigerian-British columnist Zipporah Jean, which sparked conversation all over the internet. Black America, please stop appropriating African clothing and tribal marks. The title was provocative, definitely intended to shock readers into clicking it open and having a read. The article itself was short, quite informal, but scathing and most importantly, revelatory about the rifts and relationships between Black Americans and Black Africans, and more largely, the relationships between Black Africans and the diaspora. Jean accused Black Americans of stealing and appropriating African culture, arguing that they're wearing things like Fulani septum rings and markings that look like Yoruba ones was as problematic as white Westerners doing the same. I read this article as a first-year Malawian undergraduate student, still working out my understandings of race in America. The piece drew my attention to the misunderstandings that I have seen come up over and over again ever since in the global Black community. There was clearly a cultural disconnect between Black Africans, Black Americans, Black Brits, Black Caribbean people, and these often came up in the form of diaspora wars. These wars are always tricky to talk about and sticky to wade through, because how do we hold the unspeakably violent events that led to our separations? How do we account for the geopolitical disparity that our different nation states, some first world, some third, facilitate? How do we speak of colonialism, of chattel slavery, of their legacy in shaping us without engaging in strange competition about who is most oppressed? Having closely followed the conversation surrounding Jean's article, I wondered what possibilities existed for robust transnational coalitions and conversations between Black people globally that cut across the various lines of separation so that we really hear each other. This line of questioning made me consider Jean's article as a sign of deep-seated, complicated disconnect between these groups that need to be contended with in serious ways. Recent years have brought about a dynamic shift in global Black interactions. Social media has led to connections, discourse, and the occasional diaspora war, yes. Pop cultural productions such as Beyoncé's Black is King and Marvel's Black Panther have, in their own ways, to various levels of success, attempted to showcase the rich entwined histories of Black groups worldwide. The rise of Afrobeats as a leading genre in music charts has connected Black people musically in a new way. A seemingly newfound passion for Black travel has emerged, accompanied with some African governments even inviting the Black diaspora back to the continent. However, these connections are not new. Throughout history, Black African diaspora have sought ways to reconnect to the continent. Around the time I read this article, I was taking an African history class as part of my African studies major and reading Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. I discovered Rodney's transcontinental connections and learned that he authored a book while teaching at the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. This opened my mind up to the kinds of intellectual and artistic exchanges that had occurred in the global Black community at the time and throughout history. From Marcus Garvey's famous calls for Black people to return to Africa, to Nina Simone's time spent in Senegal, to James Baldwin's travels in West Africa, Black African diaspora had been reaching across time zones, oceans, and moments in history in various waves of return. But it's the new returns that I'm interested in. The festivals, the roots tourism, the study abroad programs, the desire to buy land and move to different parts of the continent, both in a bid to flee the racism in the world at large, but also to feel a newfound sense of connection to the continent. But as meaningful as they are for those who return, these returns can be messy and complicated, often revealing challenges such as inequitable geopolitical positions that allow for some groups to travel with greater ease than others. They reveal the effect of centuries of separation and the gaps in knowledge between all of these Black groups and their entwined histories. In the following conversation, I hear from Kalila Logan, who offers her reflections on her experiences as a Jamaican woman raised in the United States who spent some time studying and working in Ghana and Tanzania. Lila talks a bit about her journey, thoughts, and also recounts the experience she had while attending Ghana's 2019 year of return. I find Lila's reflections deeply thoughtful, very well considered, and telling about the different issues that can come up with Black diasporic travel on the African continent. This episode is made with a deep love for the global Black community and with the hope that by having conversations like these, we will ensure that we reconnect meaningfully, equitably, and in the way that uplifts us all. I hope you enjoy.
Okay. All right, well, so my name is Kalila Logan. I also answer to Lila. I'm originally from Kingston, Jamaica, and I'd say I'm a local to the US, specifically New York City. And as far as lineage goes, I think ancestrally there are some ties to Nigeria, as well as just through movement, Ghana and Tanzania. I visited some other countries, haven't called them home just yet, but there's more to come there. I am currently a digital media manager for an arts nonprofit here in the US. I attended New York University and Stanford University. Okay, so I'm in such an interesting space when it comes to this conversation because I studied abroad in Ghana in 2016, and that was before the return. So I essentially added an extra year to my undergraduate career to study abroad in Ghana. It was all supposed to be fine if I had just done the one semester, but I got there and like a couple months in was like, I'm staying for a year. It wasn't just because of like chopping life or enjoyment or anything like that. Because when I went to NYU, I came in as a like aspiring journalism student. And I wanted to study abroad in China and in Shanghai specifically and learn Mandarin because like most of the world speaks Mandarin. I ended up in the individualized study program. And when I shifted, I decided to focus on globalization and like questions around development and identity and media and narratives and still elements of journalism in that. And slowly but surely education got looped in. And I think education got looped in because of my own identity as an immigrant to the US. And I was just thinking about like the way that I view the world or specifically like the US and life here is from the lens of like being othered, but also having like a different education initially. I started primary school outside the country. I came here, had the very aggressive experience of moving from Jamaica to Texas. I was in ESL classes for someone who spoke fluent English. So I just had like a very intense, I guess, assimilation process in a way. It was this like, you're an immigrant alien, don't speak English. Oh, but you're actually smart. And then, you know, I lived in different states in the South, came to NYU. And so all of my understanding is from lived experience, but it's also from the lived experience of someone who sees the rest of the world. When I think of the world, I don't just see America when we talk about global. Whereas like for a lot of my peers, like they're thinking the 50 states sometimes, or just like the region or the community they live in. Like my notion of community was just so much more expansive. And so deciding to like study something like globalization, it's like, oh yeah, we have these amazing econ professors, amazing sociologists, amazing researchers, but it just wasn't sitting right that I was talking about something like globalization in this very detached way without engaging in a space where it was like happening in real time and people are grappling with the different phases. And like, so when I got to Accra and I started taking my classes, I was like, this is where I need to be. Like, there's so much more that I've just done in the first couple weeks of being here that I would never have touched on in NYU, New York. Because I think also with when you're doing individualized study, you have an advisor and it's you, and like you're doing a lot of the research and the labor, but then they're supposed to guide you. But it's like, if they're coming from the same limited purview, then how much, how expansive is that work, you know? So, I mean, I had amazing African professors, specifically African women. Like, they were asking me the hard questions. Like, they were like, okay, you're a Jamaican who lives in America, but you're here in Ghana and nobody's like reading you as that. Like, how are you existing in this space? Like, what are you thinking about education? What are you thinking about the norms culturally? Like, you know, because I always thought like, oh, this is similar to back home. But I wasn't thinking about like the way that colonialism had informed my own understanding of things, like just simple things as to like the language that I used, the jargon that I was using, the practices, like my identity of like proper, you know, etiquette, like things like that. And so then it was like learning and unlearning that in the US and then going to Ghana and being like, where my whole existence is being perceived as like elite American, foreigner who is also Black, but the elite sort of outweighs the Blackness in that sense. Like, I was super excited, like, yeah, I'm in a Black majority country, this feels great, this feels normal, but the Blackness was coded, you know? And so, and the spaces I had access to, like when I was socializing, I was like around expats, a lot of them Lebanese or European. And because of the language I spoke and the accent I had, that was a signal for interest. Whereas like at the same time I was seeing like Ghanaians, you know, being treated a certain way because of the fact that they were Ghanaian and like very clearly so and presented physically so. I also was for the first time confronted with colorism, you know, like I never, to me, I'm a brown skinned girl. My mom, my stepmother's light skin. So I'd always perceive myself as dark, not dark skin, but like darker. But when I was in Ghana, I was light to people. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. I didn't reject it initially. I just like thought it was like ridiculous kind of. And no one necessarily, I didn't have any confrontation or anything like that, but I just noticed like in the comments that people would make and even just like the need to want to know where I was from. And so I detached from all of these like aspects of identity. I was having this like very introspective period of like understanding my position in the world, how much space that I want to take up. Like, I just felt like I was being confronted with questions that I'd never had to think about, not once, because within the US context, it was like, you're a minority student who can't afford anything like in the space that you exist in. Like, you're not supposed to be at this elite institution. Whereas like step out of the country and I'm really thinking about, I have the option of going to graduate school. I am not first gen because my dad went to university. I'm in this weird generation 1.5 that has a lived experience outside the US, but also was primarily raised in the US. So like most people associate me with being more American than anything else, although I myself don't identify that way. And so I think like at the time, Ghana had had, you know, a lot of people that had come from other countries, and people were always telling me about like Rita Marley and all these other people from Jamaica that had settled down. But it was still very new to be a Black foreigner in the space that was just, that wasn't just like visiting to go to Cape Coast and then going home. Like, most people were surprised that I visited every region in Ghana. Most people were surprised that I was like interested in talking about like what was happening politically. So I had a really great experience. It really shifted the way I thought about things, what I wanted to do with my life, and not just in terms of work, but how I wanted to engage with the world. Like, I didn't want to constantly And I was like, no, I don't need to continuously be catering to this American notion of America being the center of the universe. Like, and therefore, that doesn't mean I have to live and work in America for the rest of my life. It doesn't mean that your work is more valuable if you are in America or vice versa. And I think I also felt like sort of this responsibility of like wanting to understand the dynamics of what were happening in other parts of the diaspora, because I'm like, I know what's going on in Jamaica and I see parallels here, but like these conversations aren't happening. They're happening in a very disjointed way where it's like very country by country basis, or regional Africa, regional Caribbean, or, you know, and I was just kind of like, we're grappling with the same thing, colonialism. We're trying to get rid of like these heads of state that just have nothing to do with our culture, our history, our narratives. We're dealing with spirituality and like, what does it mean to be Christian but acknowledge like spiritual origins? What does it mean to be, you know, like have queer people in society that need your protection and allyship when Christianity has essentially demonized that as an existence or anything associated with? What does it mean to like acknowledge the dimensions of our blackness? Because I think if you've traveled or if you've left home, you're not considered to be the same level of whether it's African or Caribbean that you are. Mm-hmm. And borders and globalization shifts all of that. So it's like the level of movement has increased so much that all of that is archaic information.
So this is how the story goes. Lila moves to Ghana right before the Year of Return happens. The Year of Return is part of Ghana's effort to boost its tourism, as well as to give Black African diaspora a chance to reconnect with the continent. It is not a new phenomenon. For decades, a kind of tourism called roots tourism has existed under the umbrella of heritage tourism. More broadly, heritage tourism refers to the practice of traveling to places that have significant cultural, historical, or natural value. Heritage tourism aims to provide travelers with a deeper understanding of the places they visit and the cultural and historical context that have shaped them. Roots tourism, which is typically categorized under heritage tourism, is also known as ancestral tourism and is a type of tourism that involves traveling to a place of origin or a homeland of one's family or ancestors. It's a form of heritage tourism, yes, but it focuses on personal and familial connections to a particular place. It involves tracing one's family tree, visiting locations where ancestors lived, worked, and in the case of West African coasts and Black African diaspora, the sites where enslaved Africans were shipped away. Roots tourism is often motivated by a desire to learn more about one's an ancestral history and to connect with the customs, traditions, and values of one's ancestor. In the case, again, of Black African diaspora who are separated from the continent through enslavement, it is a chance to facilitate a sort of personal reconnection and closure, and is often a very emotional and deeply spiritual experience for many. Now, Ghana's Year of Return, in a sense, taps into the sentiments of roots tourism. But many critics have also looked at it with a keen eye and kind of examined its more economic motivations. On the one hand, it is a very meaningful experience for Black African diaspora, but on the other, it is a way of a nation state hitting its bottom line and making a profit off of something that has very high demand, and understandably so. In the particular case of Ghana's Year of Return, while many of the sites that were already visited as part of roots tourism in Ghana, including Cape Coast, there have also been a series of festivals such as Afro Nation, Afrochella, all under the umbrella of the Year of Return. In the next part of my conversation with Lila, I asked her about her experiences in this and heard about her reflections around roots tourism, heritage tourism, and some of the things that we need to consider as we seek to form these reconnections between Black Africans and Black African diaspora from all around the world. So you moved to Ghana kind of before the whole Year of Return hype started, and really at a time when it wasn't really in the front of people's minds that Black people were flocking to Ghana. What was your experience of moving there as a student and then expressing the desire to extend your stay? What were people's response to this in your life?
Like, everyone thought I'd lost my mind because it was like, how do you go to a school that costs $250,000 and then say, I'm going to go do a stipend fellowship in East Africa and there's no salary of any kind? And I did it. And not a single friend was like, I'm going to come visit you. They were like, we'll see you when you come back. You know, like, it was this very distance and removed notion of like, you're going to another planet where we can't exist with you, where we can't feed into or be a part of your community. And so we'll just see you when you come back. And it wasn't like, it wasn't possible. Like, I had friends that had come to visit while I was in Ghana and they were like, oh, this is so nice, you know? But something about it being less developed, less familiar, less made it impossible. So this is now 2019 and we're hitting year return. And the amount of people I knew going to Ghana, the number just shot up. So really what the conversation went from like, we're all like very concerned at the fact that you have decided to live your life this way. But now that Boris Kodjo and his wife have made it normal for us to go to the continent and they've invited every celebrity known to man to the continent, like, I want to be there too. It looks so fun. I'm dumbfounded by the amount of people that now want it to go. And like, I have to get to Ghana and the Shade Room is posting about it and all of these things. But I won't lie to you. I was like disappointed because the conversations had lost dimension. Mm. Like, it was very clearly becoming, we belong here. We need to go back. We, you know, Black is King. And I love that there's an innate value in that, but I think the buck was just stopping right. And it was almost like too much escapism, you know? Like, I think it does happen for people, especially if you go to like Cape Coast, you're confronted directly with like your history. And I don't know anyone who hasn't gone, like who's gone there and not felt insanely emotional because it's like, you feel the presence, like you just feel it. And so, at the same time, though, I do think it's like been repackaged into like, these are investment opportunities, these are enjoyment opportunities. It's not right. Like, I have friends who can't afford things anymore because of how things are shifting. And I think that's a part of our responsibility in the diaspora, is not just to like mimic colonial norms. Like, we're supposed to come in. I think that part is lacking. And I think it makes it hard for us to then turn around and enter these spaces and really recognize the need to invest and preserve, not just enjoy.
Right.
And it's complicated. I went in 2019, I remember being at Afro Nation and I was like, oh, this is crazy. Like, I am experiencing greatness right now. You know, all these Afrobeats artists are performing. And I looked around at like who was organizing the festival. It was just like white people. But they had organized it. Like, Afro Nation was not Black. And then there was Afrocella, which is more of a diasporic situation. So they also happened. So they happened on the same day. Because I think Afrocella, I believe, is a 1-day festival at the time. And then Afro Nation was a 2-day festival or 3-day. I can't remember how many days it was. But I remember going from one to the other that day. And the
like, what year was this?
2019.
So all of this is happening in the year of return. Okay.
So this was like, because 2018 was the year of return when it was just mostly celebrities. And then 2019 was like the first time that like everyone started going. And so I remember being there because I was in Tanzania at the time. So I traveled from Tanzania to the festival. And I remember being so excited because I remember traveling. I flew from Tanzania to Rwanda, Rwanda to Nigeria to Accra. My entire flight was going for Afro Nation.
Wow.
Like, at the airport in Rwanda, everyone gets on the plane. So, but we're on the flight. And I mean, there are Ugandans on my flight. I mean, it was like Soul Plane. but like the diaspora. People were playing music, people were whipping, you know, like the snacks that you'll buy, like the different street snacks you can buy, like depending on your country, like they have different snacks. So like it would be like the trail mix or the chips or the baobab or whatever. Like I felt it was crazy because it was like almost this like market on a plane. But there was like this discourse being interacting. People were talking about who they were going to see, their plans, where they were staying, what they were going to do. And it was like, we all have some level of privilege to be doing this trip, one.
Right.
And we're all from different places, different shared experiences. But I'm not even going to lie, it felt religious and spiritual when we were sitting on the tarmac in Nigeria, because like the layover in Nigeria wasn't like, we weren't getting off the plane. It was just 30 minutes. I mean, they were just gassing up or something. Someone started playing the music from the festival, like playing the music from the lineup. And it was like, people started dancing and singing. And it was like almost being in like a utopia. I was like, this is not real. And I know I'm never going to experience this again in my life. And so I want to sit with this, but I also want to process this. And like, it took everything in me not to like record, because I wanted to, because I was just like, this is never going to happen again, I'm sure, in my lifetime. I'll never see anything like this. Because I knew that right in that moment, I was like, this is what the return is going to do to the continent, but like on an exponential level. Like, it's going to bring people, it's going to bring cultures. Like, there's going to be, and I was like, but this, and this moment that I experienced is a great one, but I immediately started to see like the idiosyncrasies, I guess, that would make it negative. Like, there was a moment when this girl who's from Uganda, who clearly had money, like she was wearing designer, like the woman in the seat next to her, like maybe said something about how expensive the tickets were. And she was like, you know, and I was like, no, you know, that's when I was like, okay, the crack, the simulation is over. Like we're back. And you know, when we landed, like everyone went their separate ways. No one even spoke to each other. Like it was as if it didn't happen. And so I was just thinking about like, we can't escape it. Like it's going to, you know, like the answer isn't going to be resources. The answer isn't going to just be, you know, access and opportunity. It's going to take real work from all of us, right? Because there's so much that we are carrying that is like causing these limitations between us.
Right.
Even if we solve the issue of the colonizer, it's embedded in us already. It's too far gone. We've been carrying it for generations. And now with this return, there is limitations on who gets to return, how you get to return, who you get to interact with, what does your enjoyment look like, how much dialogue are you having? And so, and we've seen it, right? Like you see the TikToks of like, I'm braiding my hair in Ghana for $50. And this is the experience, or I'm getting my nails done. Like all the things that like we rave about sort of about being really convenient. Like, why is it cheap?
Why is it cheap? That's exactly the question. I think when you're speaking about the braiding conversation, every time I hear people talk about how cheap it is to get braids done, it suggests to me that a person is thinking in dollars. It's very easy to feel that way. I traveled to the States twice in the past couple, like in the past 4 months, and each time it was my first time being back in the States since 2018. And when I went in December, I was just gobsmacked at how expensive everything felt. And I remember feeling the reverse when I moved to South Africa, feeling like everything was cheap. But cheap is really a matter of what currency you're operating in, and cost of living and adjusting for all of that. And which is what makes, I think, these kinds of gatherings not feel very equitable, because I'm thinking of, you know, and even in a world where we're like, borders are gone, we're going to do a gathering in Brooklyn, New York, and then we're going to do one in Lagos, Nigeria, and then we're going to do one in Lilongwe, Malawi. Just whose money would carry them far? Because I know that my people operating in Malawi and Kwaja going to Brooklyn, New York could probably buy one pizza and that's it. And then it's like, oh, my whole budget is blown for the whole weekend. And I think
barriers, borders are gone, but barriers exist.
barriers exist, and I think it also just shows that we are, you know, products of our nationalities, of our race, of our socioeconomic context, of our, that we occupy so many worlds at once. And when we think of this idea of a global Black community, if we don't account for the different sites that we exist in, then we leave a whole bunch of people out. Because I'm thinking of just knowing that Accra, for example, is a city that's very known for having some of the most exorbitant real estate prices, and then having these patterns of people wanting to buy land in a bid to reconnect to a continent that they were stripped from very violently, which I also hold a lot of respect for. But holding those two things in tandem, they are at odds, and their intention.
That's when, you know, the fog, the rose-colored glasses came on. I was like, okay, like, I was in, and I had a good time. I really did, but I remember always having this dual experience of, like, this is so much fun, but also, like, there's so much complexity to this, because I'm thinking about the man who's downstairs parking these cars, and how much of a tip he's not getting, or, you know, like, this market that we're going to, people are really enjoying purchasing items, but at the same time, they're not really investing because they're haggling to the point where it's not even reasonable anymore because of the, like, experience of haggling. Or I think what was the hardest for me was when people were throwing money at situations. And it just was getting, like, dehumanizing. And I don't even think I was having, like, the elite of the elite experiences. Definitely not. But it was just in the smallest things, like in the club, you know, like the section, the bottle wars, the, it was just like, this is turning into New York City.
Can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by throwing money at situations? Maybe if you've got examples of what that looks like.
So I think, like, there was a particular situation where a guy had ordered a section ahead of time, and he and his friends were there, and these are Ghanaians, and they had already had their section, and a group of, like, I want to say there's maybe one Ghanaian in the group, and everyone else was, like, Black foreigner from the UK or the US or wherever. They came to the club with a large group, and they wanted the section. They wanted a section. There were no more sections. So because this other small group was already in a section, they were like, we want that table. And the waiter who's handling the situation was like, oh, like, he already paid for it. And they were like, we'll pay you triple.
Wow.
You know? Mm. And so it was like that person was dismissed or, like, told, you know, to go. And so I was like, they don't know that if this man is also coming to return, is returning from something. Because that's the thing, like, before Ember season, like, was a return for people who are already from these countries.
Right.
This return now is just, like, a calling to others to join in on the return that's already been happening. So it's like their experience is being shattered because we're invading. We're invading it. And, you know, it's like now, I think in the past couple of years, what I've seen is, like, a lot of people who do, if they're going to return, they don't stay in the city. They go elsewhere. They leave the city and they're returning in other parts. And I think, I guess, in some ways that's a positive because now, like, maybe Kumasi or other parts of Ghana are going to get a lot more attention. But, you know, that also then means the cost of living in those places are going to increase. Right. And so it's like, how are we mitigating this? Like, do we need a czar or someone over the public realm that's going to support and, like, establish rules and regulations? Because it's like
the czar of the return.
The czar of the return. Because already across, you know, there's the issues of land grabs. Like, people are now, you know, a lot of African Americans are wanting to buy land and property and all this stuff. And I'm like, land disputes are already crazy. Like, between family members, you know, one cousin might sell the land, other cousin doesn't know, or the impersonation or selling lands to the government, all types of things happen. And then you have foreigners that are coming in ready to buy land. And Ghana has bent over backwards to accommodate a lot of things. I mean, I remember when I went to Ghana, I had to buy a visa. That was 2016. I'm Jamaican. I travel on my Jamaican passport. And by the time I went back in 2019, I was visa free.
Wow.
And then this, I think, has happened for a lot of Commonwealth countries now. And so that's another thing, too, is like the dynamic of like, okay, we're trying to get rid of our Commonwealth head of state, but are we still a Commonwealth? And like, what does that look like? Are we shifting into like more of a pan-diasporic situation, you know, in how we relate to one another? Because I can't say that it's necessarily easier for Ghanaians to travel to Jamaica, even though it's visa free for them. You know, I can't say that. I definitely feel like as a member of the Commonwealth, I do have it easier to, travel to, you know, certain countries on the continent, all. But, and I think that sort of extension is important, but I also think that contextually, how do we mitigate the ease? And like, how are we looking at ease and discussing it? Because I don't think it's easier for Ghanaians to travel to the US, is it? I don't think that's happening. And I also think that people making the return are not having these conversations. I don't know, like, I'm not sitting on my high horse and like saying like, oh, everyone needs to have this conversation if they're going to go. But I do think that there is a responsibility to be mindful of how we're engaging and traveling and interacting as members of the diaspora, because the buck doesn't stop with a 10-day vacation, you know, and it doesn't stop with going to the arts market and buying like 50 souvenirs and, you know, being like, oh yeah, I contributed to Ghana. I don't think it stops there. Because I, at the same time, like, Ghana's struggling economically, and I bet you everyone's still going this December. Like, what's happening all year? Like, when I'm checking in with my friends, like, they're going through it, you know? And while everyone, you know, wants like that influx of money, it's like, how much of that influx of money is actually going to Ghanaians? Because there's so many, you know, foreign investors that have controlled things for a very long time, that what we're seeing isn't actually necessarily a transaction that's benefiting the country at all. And so I think it just gets very complicated and complex, because even from like a media standpoint, we're becoming more aware.
Still no sign.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean, though. I'm saying, like, there's this, we're sort of leveraging African creativity now. Like, I mean, look at Chanel and doing the show in Senegal. There is this push, and I'm even starting to see it now. And I think maybe because I am really close to a lot of African creatives, like, I've seen when brands just like dip their toe and like take the aesthetic, or they're pulling on it. Like, I'm starting, you know, like, you know, I think that if we're amplifying, we need to still be mindful of origin. We need to be mindful of credibility. We need to be mindful of mobility.
Right.
Because even then, like, who are we, like, there's clearly still a gatekeeping, green lighting process going on of what's allowed, what's not allowed. Like, right now I'm trying to plan my birthday trip to Senegal. And I'm nervous because this will be the first time I'm traveling with like friends from the US to a country. Usually I do a lot of my travel alone, or like people more of just like living abroad, and like if I ran into people it's fine, but this is the first time where I'm going with people, and I think like part of me is afraid to see how they're going to interact with the continent.
I
know that some of them have been before, but I think it's sort of this like, and I don't think it's the exact same thing, but it's like, oh, is my aunt racist, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there's the questions that like the woke whites have to deal with, like, is she gonna say something crazy at dinner in front of my black friend, you know? So is my friend going to say something really ignorant, or do something very ignorant, or, you know, like when put in a situation, the positionality shifts in real time all the time. But I think especially when you're going to a place where it's cheap.
I think one thing that stood out to me is, are these conversations happening? And if so, where are they happening? Because I want to seek out those spaces. And if they don't exist, then how do we create them so that these events honor both the painful history of diasporic groups, but also the painful history of locals, and, you know, the shared realities that are both beautiful and like grotesque.
I think that's difficult. Because I also think that when it comes to these kinds of conversations, it takes a lot of intention for it to not become the oppression Olympics and this like hierarchy of hurt and being able to like you were saying, like simultaneously hold space for things, because it's almost, when I was studying abroad, this just like came into my mind. My roommate was African American. I remember when we went to Cape Coast as a group, because we did, like, as part of the program, they make you do group trips to Cape Coast and to Kwame Nkrumah Memorial. And we went to the Paga slave camp that's like up in the northern part of the country, because they want you to see like where the journey essentially that slaves make. So we traveled to the north. And then we also had the very emotional experience. And on the ride back, a white graduate student asked us where we were from. And right. I said, oh yeah, like my family's originally from Jamaica, et cetera. And so she asked Kayla, my roommate, where she was from. And she said, I'm from Philadelphia. And she was like, I know, but like, where are you from? Like, where's your family from?
No.
Right after. And so Kayla was obviously like incensed immediately. Like, she didn't speak. Mm-hmm. It was just like a very, you know what I mean? Like, what you would anticipate happened in terms of, but I think that moment has never left me, because that emotion, I've seen it where instead of a white person, there's an African person and they're saying, you don't know where you come from or you don't have a culture. I think the healing, like the lack of healing, and I think the lack of us holding space for one another is a part of the problem, because I think many people aren't even thinking about the different atrocities that have happened on the continent in respect to like different countries. So like apartheid, what happened in Rwanda, they don't think about how that's deeply affected each country, because I think to some regards, like for many African Americans or like Black folks in the diaspora, Africa is a country to them still. And those nuanced existences and contexts and things are not at all being brought to the forefront. I think that's why it's really important for us to like interact in general, but not just from this notion of shared trauma, but like the individual natures of our experiences.
Yes. And yeah, you know, that's sure. a direction that I hope we get to eventually. Yeah, but for now, I think as somebody who studied in the States and who also owes a big part of my own political awakening to, you know, Black thinkers and writers and poets and artists from the US, from the Caribbean, from the UK. I think it's crucial to me for us to have these conversations and to complicate the things that we take for granted, and to also to see our shared, what's shared in our Blackness, but to also complicate ourselves in more ways than we have so far.
Thank you to Kalila Logan for sharing so vulnerably and for your honest and astute reflections. Although my conversation with Lila mostly focused on returns and reconnection through tourism, I want to reiterate that there is a long and rich history of connection politically, intellectually, and artistically in so many more ways than the scope of this episode can allow. I want to leave you with one of these examples. In an open letter by writer, thinker, poet, activist Audre Lorde, she implores African Americans to align themselves with the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. It is called, "We Must Learn to Use Our Power on Apartheid, Police Brutality, and Internationalism." She writes this note in 1985. It expresses the kinds of possibilities that exist when we as Black people globally align ourselves towards common goals of liberation. The last paragraph of this essay reads, "The connection between Africans and African Americans, African Europeans, African Asians is real, however dimly seen at times, and we all need to examine without sentimentality or stereotype what the injection of Africanness into the socio-political consciousness of the world could mean. We need to join our differences and articulate our particular strengths in the service of our mutual survivals and against the desperate backlash which attempts to keep that Africanness from altering the very basis of current world power and privilege. I hope that this episode raised some important questions for you around what we should be thinking about when we consider diasporic reconnections, especially as they play out on the continent in contemporary times. My name is Dawanda Busila Sempere, and I thank you for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwu Fananya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, Harry Stoltz, and Macheri Muguero. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Ami Tamaklo, Fu Asedu, Exidi Olugu, Basil Ibrahim, and Hopalong Botulkane. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.